Hello, this is Mixed Media Audio Zine for November 2012 with DJ Frederick. Mixed Media is about do-it-yourself publishing, taking a look at homemade publications in the digital age. Blogs can be deleted. Paper has an archival quality that can be read for decades to come. Making a zine is a hands-on act of creation, putting your work out into the tangible world to share with others. Mixed Media Audio Zine is also about discovering new independent music, and I'm going to start off this edition of Mixed Media Audio Zine reading a piece called Voyage of the Night, written by Anthony, who publishes Communicating Vessels, and this is from issue number 24, Fall-Winter 2012-2013. Voyage of the Night. Rare is the moment when we can quietly put aside our problems and fears and our perpetual busyness. The slow tempo and solitude of the night, I am learning, has contributed to my own well-being. When the day slows down and the light becomes ever more obscured by shades of darkness, a sense of wonder and mystery seems to unfold. That is, if you attune yourself to it. Nocturnal creatures like bats, owls, venomous Gila monsters, javelinas, pythons, and toads emerge from their hiding place. They fly, crawl, hop, slither, in an effort to catch their prey. It is feeding time. While they are busy devouring as well as digesting their prey, a clear night can bring the stars into focus with the moon, and the yipping of coyotes in the distance can have a humbling effect on overweening human vanity and hubris, possibly making us realize how insignificant and small the human mind and human experience can sometimes be. We are a part of a huge picture that could never be painted with a broad brushstroke. The night sky and beasts of the darkness, likewise, can be drawn and conceptualized, yet the canvas will never be vast enough to encompass those things that we are unable to see or explain. Perhaps it is best to leave it that way, unfinished, slightly ragged at the edges, and open to further exploration. The beauty of the night lies in not knowing the full secrets of its mystery. Its symbolism in history is drenched with rich meaning as well as nuance. In pre-industrial Europe, night was often regarded by the popular imagination as a time in which responsibilities and duties were held in abeyance, thus clearing the way for freedoms never allowed during the daytime. Sinning and law-breaking among the lower classes became common once the sun disappeared. The night gave cover to acts of revelry and lewdness. Carnivals and festivals beginning in the day could go on into the night and escalate into popular attacks on ruling elites. The night was awash in masks and disguises. Appearances were deceiving. During the brightness of the day, your eyes saw friends, acquaintances, and fellow workers. At night, your view of the same people was blurred by the darkness. Special occasions heightened this falseness of appearance by the addition of costumes and masks. Yet it was not only the lower classes that set upon the night like a chariot navigating its way through a dimly lit passage. The Middle Ages, the age of King Arthur and his court, brought us castles standing in the air against the backdrop of torches and candles suspended in time. Elaborate parties and ceremonies were staged, frequently culminating in raucous drunkenness and lusty behavior. With the breakdown of the Middle Ages, aristocracies took to more refined and cultivated pleasures at night. The 18th century adventurer and lover of woman, Giacomo Casanova, endlessly describes and discusses the nightlife of royalty in his autobiography, History of My Life. He takes us to operas, masked balls, dinner parties, and concerts in Europe. Possibly the most remarkable and intriguing episode in his autobiography is his love affair with a nun. Meeting one another in masked darkness, they would dine, rent a room, and let the night take them away. He experienced these liaisons and masquerades at a time in the mid-18th century when the war against the night was already underway. The shots fired against the night included the imposition of artificial lighting, curfews, night watchmen, lockdowns, and the banning of public assemblies after dark. Governments and religious institutions and ruling economic elites sought to protect their own interests while simultaneously enlarging and fortifying the role of policing, religion, and property rights in people's daily lives. But late medieval and early modern Europe authorities were unable to systematically enforce the laws passed against nocturnal passions until the industrialized illumination of cities, towns, and villages. Nighttime activities, henceforth, were more easily scrutinized by the authorities. Naughty behavior was punished accordingly. History is, however, never a one-way street. So it was with certain benefits reaped from industrialized lighting. Individuals and couples felt safer venturing out after the sun went down. The streets seemed less hostile and increasingly social. And with the concomitant rise of ideas spread by the Enlightenment in the 18th and 19th centuries, the black holes of magic and superstition were filled with the light of reason. Samuel Pepys, the 17th century diarist, gives us glimpses and intimations of what the night might have been like before the widespread introduction of lamps in London. Pepys colorfully depicts his nocturnal jaunts with a mixture of glee, romance, fear, and magic. His childlike marvel at observing glowworms in the dark is matched by the sense of panic that overpowers him when he is making his way on foot or by coach through an unknown or potentially dangerous part of town. Then there are stories Pepys conveys. One of the strangest involves Alderman Bence's stumbling at night over a dead corpse in the street and going home and telling his wife, "She, at the fright, being with child, fell sick and died of the plague." This was during the Great Plague of 1665. The nightly rituals he maintained were equally as fanciful. Pepys trained his servants how to sing and read by his bedside before he nodded off for the night. The absence of the night lights allowed him to enter a state of deep sleep, a state in which dream and nightmare coalesced. Pepys had dreams of wild sexual conquests as well as stormy love affairs. His nightmares were often reflections of his worries and obsessions. This nightly realm, this area of solitude and unconscious wishes and notions, was seen as more than a period of rest and relaxation from the daily chores of the day. It was endowed with a pace and meaning of its own. Pepys paid attention to his dreams and nightmares, and the people who lived at that time did the same. Pursuing the rhythm of the night is becoming harder and harder to effectively do. Now we have cities that never sleep, and people who are too busy trying to survive in the workaday world to give much thought or attention to the shadows, shapes, and patterns of night. These apparitions, these haunting owl-infested chapels, these images of solitude, strength, horror, beauty, and loneliness were once the basis of myth and folklore. With only the glow of the fire, family and friends would relate tales of knights on horseback maneuvering their way back through nights of hostile and eerie storms, of bats flying out of the belfry at the stroke of midnight, of forests coming alive with vampires and werewolves in the time after sunset, of nocturnal wanderings of witches, magicians, and hermetic eccentrics. Slowly, the mysteries of the night faded away. Floodlights and glowing screens have replaced torches of flame blowing in the wind. Knights of the Middle Ages kept an eye on the torches that hung on the tower of the castle, lest they be snuffed out by torrential downpours and the shifting tides of enemy attack. Today, we cannot get away from the light. It travels with us everywhere we go. It gives us fragmentary dreams and nightmares, ones that are ignored or quickly forgotten. This is what happens when we fail to allow the time and space for deep sleep. Sleep, then, tends to be viewed as something we do in order to make way for the next day of work, and that is a generous statement. There are vast numbers of people in the Western world who consciously avoid sleep as much as possible, regarding it as an interference with their busy lives. There's no way around it. Today you have to keep on your toes. The nocturnal sphere, the place where dreams and nightmares are made, as well as retrieved and synthesized, is slipping away before our eyes. With effort and diligence, pieces and shades of darkness can be salvaged and sewn back together. Yet the blinding lights seduce and beckon us forward. It takes courage and strength to resist them by walking the other way, using the stars as our guidepost. And that was an excerpt from the essay Voyage of the Night, published in Communicating Vessels, issue number 24. That was a song by The Christian Bookshop, A Million Stars, These Kids. This is DJ Frederick. You're listening to the Mixed Media Audio Zine for November 2012. And I'd like to read some more from Zine Capsule, a zine about preserving zines for the future. Like books, the best way to house a zine, if not in a stiff protective housing, like a pamphlet folder, is storing them with the spines down, intact, folded, and using a plastic bin. If you don't have access to individual envelopes or pH-balanced Mylar, each zine could be wrapped in acid-free, lignin-free paper. You can buy a ream, 50 sheets of this paper for a good price, or split the cost with a friend. The outside of the paper wrap could be then marked in pencil with your own cataloging system for easy retrieval or some sort of color-coding labels. Stay away from using adhesives like sticky notes, glue, tape, rubber bands, and metal paper clips. Plastic clips are okay, but over time they indent paper. As a general rule, you might want to remove staples, rubber bands, and metal fasteners as well, unless you feel really strongly about the integrity of that object to the zine itself. Attachments like correspondence with zines could be wrapped separately and placed next to that zine with the same identification. Many libraries undo the binding staple and store their non-circulating archive copies flat or unbound. This would work too, and that way you could put one zine per folder in or between two sheets of acid-free paper or cardstock in a file box type plastic container, literally like a filing system. Be mindful, and don't be afraid to be creative with your housing. An old dresser might work, but watch out for silverfish.
Hello, I'm Kate Lopresti. I'm reading from Constant Rider number 4. My zine about public transit adventures in Portland. Books on the Bus, a Bibliography. In an effort to research the impact of portable text on the developing TriMet literary movement, I've collected the following titles from my fellow passengers. Literati who took the time while riding to read a bit of prose. Call it poetry in motion. Call it literary multitasking. Call it an illusory respite from the twice-daily, hour-long commute to the mind-numbing job that is slowly ripping the soul from your body, these are the titles I found aboard the bus and Max during the summer of 2002. Time, June 21st, 8 a.m. Route, 15 Belmont. Too perky, too early in the morning, an egg-shaped man in his early 40s bounded up the bus steps, his stringy red hair flowing behind him. He was bald on top, but had grown shoulder-length hair from the crown of his scalp. He wore a white t-shirt and knee-length jean shorts, the waistband of which he ceremoniously adjusted before he sat down to read Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy. Time, June 25th, 5:15 p.m. Route, Max to Gresham. 9-to-5 working woman, pale with freckles, frizzy hair. For the office, a black skirt with white polka dots and matching blouse. For commuting and power walks at lunch, running shoes. She looked a little thin, but maybe that will change when she finishes The Well-Fed Backpacker by June Fleming. Time, July 3rd, 3:15 p.m. Route, Max to Gresham. This teenage male modeled a black running suit offset by a red bandana tied to his head. He idly reclined over two seats and, while the rest of us stood too intimidated to ask him to move over, he read The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment by Thaddeus Golis. Time, July 12th, early evening. Route, 14 Hawthorne. Sitting near the driver, cautious not to miss his stop, this gentleman periodically smoothed his comb over and adjusted his glasses, though they were strapped to his head. Blue t-shirt, work pants, brown leather work boots, different colored laces, one black, one gray. Rubber band on left wrist. His breast pocket bulged with a devotional prayer booklet. Time, July 13th, after work. Route, Max to Gresham. A fat man with a surprisingly buoyant carriage modeled a goatee and an enormous sky blue T is for tent shirt. He bounced off the train carrying a bedroom pillow and a paperback copy of Healing the Soul of America, Reclaiming Our Voices as Spiritual Citizens. Time, July 17th, 3:25 p.m. Route, 50S Merlot Road. Sex, female. Age, late 50s. Skirt length, early 20s. White hair in a Peter Pan cut. Reading glasses, black nylons, white crochet sandals. A short woman, she swung her feet 3 inches above the floor of the bus while she lost herself in Whisper of Evil by Kay Hooper. Time, July 17th, 4:35 p.m. Route, 14 Hawthorne. Male, late teens, brown corduroy cargo pants, black t-shirt, short hair, slight acne. Bored and embarrassed to be carrying the Burgerville team member training manual. Time, July 23rd, 8:05 a.m. Route, Max to Hillsboro. As I tilted my head casually to see what one passenger was reading, he purposely held the book up at a better angle to display the title, Wizard and Glass, The Dark Tower 4 by Stephen King. He then told me, "It's the fourth in a series. It's pretty good." Time, July 27th, 4:05 p.m. Route, Galleria Max stop. Heavy teenage girl, tan shorts, white blouse, blonde hair swept in wraparound braids. Carried a purse and a backpack. Tried to look badass as she smoked, but that appearance was weakened as she moved her lips while reading Emma by Jane Austen. Time, July 29th, 7:55 a.m. Route, Max to Hillsboro. This large barge stood on the train in a white work shirt and blue khakis. In his left hand, he exercised a hand grip, while in his right hand, he held the book Windows 2000, A Beginner's Guide. Time, July 29th, 8:10 p.m. Route, 14 Hawthorne. Woman in her mid-40s, short, dark hair with silver streaks. A haircut from the era when hair was frosted instead of treated with highlights. Glasses, also frosted. Her clothes nearly duplicated my late 80s going-out getup. A breezy, oversized white blouse, MC Hammer harem pants, and sandals. Articles she flipped through in Prevention magazine included Total Body Plan, Buried Treasure, and Outlive Your Wife. Time, August 5th, 5:25 p.m. Route, Max to Gresham. This late 40s woman dressed for comfort in elastic waist pants and tennis shoes and was minding her own business before the fare inspector came aboard and busted her for not having paid the three-zone fare. She promised to go directly to the TriMet office and upgrade her two-zone pass. The inspector wrote her a warning, which she used to bookmark Savage Bliss by Cassie Edwards. Time, August 5th, 6 p.m. Route, 4 Division. This friendly gent had a full head of hair, full beard, and a sleeveless t-shirt with a headshot front and back of Chewbacca. He also wore Teva sandals with socks and blue gym shorts. He stared intently at the map on the 4 Division bus schedule. Time, August 5th, 6 p.m. Route, 4 Division. A common sight on the bus. A young 20-something trying to reconcile his freedom of expression with the Wells Fargo dress code. Levi Dockers, blue dress shirt, and wrinkled tie in combination with multiple rings on his fingers and ears. Kudos for keeping the tattoos well hidden. Now don't let the boss man know you relieve stress after work by reading such books as Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. Time, August 13th, 6:30 p.m. Route, 14 Hawthorne. I initially mistook this passenger for a mountain of frizzy brown hair. Closer inspection revealed a woman in a black sundress with matching shawl and large wooden beaded necklace. Perched on her nose were owl eyeglasses that covered 50% of her face, and yet she still needed a magnifying glass to read, "When Anger Hurts, Quieting the Storm Within." Time, August 14th, 6:15 p.m. Route, Max to Gresham. This youthful gent tried to offset his true inner self using sleek accents such as a black t-shirt and matching pants, street-compatible bowling shoes, funky glasses, and slick black hair with tasseled bangs. But his genuine geek soul was firmly established by the IBM computer tower he carried and the naked lady on the paperback he read, Island of the Sequined Love Nun by Christopher Moore. Time, August 26th, 3:42 p.m. Route, Max DeGresham. A trim, middle-aged fellow, wearing a businessman's casual outfit all in black, mock turtleneck, pressed trousers, and wingtips somehow molded onto a tennis shoe sole. A cool ensemble, inasmuch as Men's Warehouse sells cool clothes, which is likely where he shops, because looking good and dressing sharp are tenets of Living the Seven Habits, Stories of Courage and Inspiration by Stephen R. Covey.
And that's just about it for this edition of the Mixed Media Audio Zine. If you have anything you'd like to contribute, including a zine, a reading, some music, please email me at fmoe@colby-sawyer.edu. That's fmoe@colby-sawyer.edu. We're going to cruise out listening to Papadocio and By the Light of the Stars.